I have, over the years that I have been a preacher, had people confess all different kinds of sins and temptations and weaknesses to me. I'd like to think I've been doing this long enough that it's almost impossible to surprise me with what you might confess. I've had people confess to me that they are incapable of forgiving someone who has hurt or betrayed them. I've had people confess to me that no matter how hard they try, they no longer believe in God. I've had people confess who they voted for in the last election. Of course, I've heard plenty of confessions about sexual temptation and sexual sin. But in my over 20 years as a preacher, I have never, ever, ever had anyone confess to me that they struggle with the sin of greed. No one ever comes up and says, "Hey, I really need to talk to you. Could you pray for me just late at night? I like to get on my computer and scroll through images of fancy cars. Just pray for me, please." No one ever does that. And it's not that I haven't been around some greedy people with an unhealthy attachment to money and possessions. I preach to a church that gathers in the heart of the Park Cities. You might assume that greed is the most obvious sin in our neighborhood. But it's sure not the sin we're most willing to talk about or confess or admit that we struggle with. And yet, when Jesus is getting his disciples ready for their ministry, in his teachings, he reminds them and teaches them and warns them about the danger of greed, material possessions, what we might call materialism, more than just about any other sin, except maybe for religious hypocrisy, but certainly more than sexual immorality. And it's not just the frequency with which Jesus talks about money, because read through the Gospels, he's always talking about money. Not just the frequency, it's also the way he frames the conversation. In Luke chapter 16, verse 13, he says, No one, not anyone here, can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. Now please read this next line out loud to me so we all hear what Jesus says. You cannot serve both God and money. Jesus says it's impossible. He draws a line in the sand and he says you must choose which side of the line you're going to stand on. This is not a both and, this is an either or. There's no room for compromise here. There's no room for negotiation. You can serve God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, or you can serve money, mammon in the original language, your material possessions, but you sure can't try to serve both. No one can successfully navigate that compromise. And just like all other idols, money lures us with its power, entices us to give it its allegiance, perhaps more so than any other idols. But just like all the other idols we might worship, money in the end also always leaves us disappointed. It never completely delivers what it promises. Take a look at this story in Luke chapter 12. Jesus is teaching a large crowd, and someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Presumably, this is a little brother who wants Jesus, who's obviously a teacher of great wisdom, wants Jesus to intervene in a dispute with his older brother about how to properly divide their inheritance. And rather than issuing a ruling, Jesus gives this man and everyone else in the crowd a stern warning. Here's what he says in response. Jesus replied, "Man," in the original language, it's, "come on, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? Why Why are you involving me in this? Then he said to the whole crowd, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Because life does not consist of an abundance of possessions. He asked for Jesus to give him a ruling. Jesus says, here's my warning. As if to say, why are you letting your greed, your love of money, your anxiety about your inheritance, why are you letting that come in between you and your brother? Will you really let this divide your family? One way of assessing potential idols in your life is to pay attention to what you fight over with your loved ones, your brothers and your sisters, your spouse, your business partners, your old best friends. What is it that you fight over, tend to get in a huge disagreement about? How many feuds, estrangements, divorces, dissolved partnerships can we trace back to a good old-fashioned greed-induced fight over money? To reinforce his warning about the danger of greed, then Jesus tells a story. It says in verse 16, the ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? And then Jesus adds his interpretation. This is how it will be with whomever stores up things for themselves but is not rich toward God, which is another way of saying is not generous to the poor. To be rich toward God is to be generous to the poor. The man in Jesus' story, he's totally focused on himself. It's a conversation between him and himself. Notice how many times I and my shows up in his inner dialogue. What will I do with my crops, my barns, my surplus? I will say to myself, you have everything you need to enjoy the rest of my life. God is not a part of the conversation. God is not a part of his plans, and it's not until the very end that God finally speaks and shows this rich man the folly of his ways. He's been seduced by his wealth. He's been misled. He thinks he has all he needs. He thinks his future is secure. He has more than enough. He can sit back and relax. And his wealth has given him a false sense of security, which is one of the ways that wealth can deceive. Which brings me to what Tim Keller talks about in his book, Counterfeit Gods, the deep idols of our heart. There are deep, there are surface idols, and then there are deep idols. Deep idols are based upon fundamental human desires and drives that become so important to us, we emphasize them so much, they can so dominate our lives, our attitudes, our behaviors, that they do become idolatrous, and that we begin to organize our entire lives around satisfying these needs and desires and these drives. For example, here are four examples of deep idols. The first one is power. Some people organize their life around the desire, the need to have power and influence over other people. And they will do almost anything to get it, including trade in their popularity for it. In other words, they don't care if you like them as long as they're in charge. But not everybody's like that. Not everyone has that same drive. Others have this drive, this need for approval, for acceptance. They want to be liked by others. So they will actually give up power over others in exchange for popularity. I don't have to be in charge as long as you like me. I just want to be liked. I want to be popular. Others have a desire or need for comfort. or pleasure, reducing or completely eliminating pain and suffering from their lives. Still, others have a desire or need for security, for safety, for controlling their own environment, reducing their anxiety about the future. They want to do whatever they can to control their world so they don't have to worry about what might happen tomorrow or next year. They minimize their risk. These are deep idols. Money, notice, is not a deep idol. It's a surface idol that derives its power from promising to give us what the deepest desires of our hearts crave, the deep idols of our heart. We give ourselves over to money, not for the sake of money, but for what we think money can buy us and provide for us. Take, for instance, four different people. All of them are greedy, obviously greedy. You can see their greed from a mile away. Money is their God for four very different reasons. The first person wants to be rich because she wants to gain and then exercise power and influence over others. So she will use her massive reserves of grain as leverage over the hungry people who need some help so that she can get what she wants done in the community. She'll use her wealth in exchange for political or to buy some political power. The second person wants to be rich to gain approval and acceptance from others, to gain access into certain clubs, certain social circles, wants his neighbors to be impressed with his big, shiny, brand new barns that he's just built. The third person wants to be rich so that she can enjoy the finer things in life, spend the rest of her days in absolute comfort, eat, drink, and be merry. The fourth person, though, wants to be rich so that he can sleep well at night because he knows he can handle potential adversity in the future. He's secure. Other people may stay up at night worrying about a famine, but not him. He's got plenty of grain in his barns. So do you see how money is useful then for buying what the deep idol of our heart craves and desires and wants more than anything else? Power, approval, comfort, security. It's that deep idol that's behind and beneath the greed. That's why when you find yourself in an argument with your spouse over her lavish spending habits, always wanting to buy something new, usually because the neighbors have just bought something new, or because of his Scrooge-like frugality, he's always saying no, doesn't want to spend any money, doesn't want to give away any money, just save it and keep it and hoard it. And there's always this argument about, why are you spending so much money? Well, why don't you spend some of your money? That it's really not a fight over money. It's a battle between the two competing deep idols of approval and security, both of whom are using money to serve their purposes. It's also likely that that money issue in the marriage will never be resolved. Never be resolved until you address and dethrone the deeper idols of the heart. You can move money around on the surface all you want, and it won't make a difference without addressing the idols in the heart. Now, of course, money and wealth, it's not inherently bad or evil. It's a blessing from God. It's useful. It's needed. I love what Jimmy Stewart says to Clarence the Angel in It's a Wonderful Life. It comes in pretty handy down here, bub. We need it. It's a gift from God. But like other good gifts from God, we turn it into an idol when we begin to trust it to provide what only God ultimately can give. Why is money so seductive? Why is material wealth so easy to give our allegiance to? Why does Jesus feel the need to repeatedly warn his disciples, watch out for greed? Because the truth is, money can buy some power. We see it all the time. Money can buy some approval. And money can buy comfort and pleasure. And money can buy security up to a point. And then it disappoints. Just like the foolish rich man in Jesus' story, at some point, money fails to deliver the promised security. At some point, money always lets us down. There are some problems money can't solve. Some diseases money can't heal. Some addictions money can't treat. Some marriages money can't save. And all the money in the world will not raise a single person from the dead. And so we come to the limits of our money. Like all other idols, it disappoints us and leaves us looking for something else, something more, because it doesn't deliver. And that, I believe, is why Zacchaeus was up a tree. You know the story of Zacchaeus, Luke chapter 19. Zacchaeus is a despised rich man who lives in Jericho. He's despised because he's the chief tax collector. He's the boss tax collector in Jericho because he has chosen to work with and for the hated Roman government. He's rich because he's exploited his neighbors by jacking their taxes up and then skimming some off the top for his own profit. Zacchaeus has traded wealth and power in exchange for popularity. He's likely the most hated man in all of Jericho. And one day Jesus comes to town. Zacchaeus hears about it. He wants to see Jesus, but he can't see Jesus because of the crowd, because he's short, Zacchaeus, not Jesus. So Zacchaeus runs ahead of the crowd and he climbs a tree so that he can catch a glimpse of Jesus when Jesus walks by. Now, why is Zacchaeus in that tree? Well, obviously, he's short. But why is he in the tree? Because he wants to see Jesus. Yeah, but why is he in the tree? Why does he want to see Jesus? Because the idol of money is not delivering what it promised. Something's missing from Zacchaeus' life. He's looking for something more. He has power. He's backed by the Roman army. He has wealth. He can buy whatever he wants. He can throw all kinds of lavish parties. But what good is it being able to throw a lavish party when you can't get your friends, family, and neighbors to come to your party because they all hate you? The only people he can get to come to his parties are the other tax collectors who work for him. And even then, he's not sure. Are they coming to my party because they like me or just because I'm the boss? Do they laugh at my jokes because I'm funny or just because I'm in charge? And so there he is up a tree. The rich but oh so poor Zacchaeus. And Jesus sees him in the tree. And what happens next is pure gospel. Let's begin reading in verse 5. It says, when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. And all the people saw this, and they began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times that amount. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham. Jesus sees Zacchaeus in the tree and he sees an opportunity. What he sees is a heart that is wide open. And so Jesus invites himself over to Zacchaeus' house for dinner because that's what Jesus does. And we don't know how long they're together. We don't know what they talk about over dinner, how many parables Jesus tells Zacchaeus, how many questions Zacchaeus asked Jesus, but at some point in the conversation, he stands up and makes a declaration. He says, from this point forward, I'm going to start giving my stuff away to the poor, and I'm going to pay back whatever I have stolen plus interest. And this leads Jesus to make a declaration of his own. He says, today salvation has come to this house. This man belongs to the family of God too. Salvation has come to his house not because Zacchaeus has suddenly decided to start giving his money away. Well, that's the result of salvation coming to his house. Salvation came to his house when Jesus saw him up a tree and invited himself over for dinner. Salvation came to Zacchaeus' house when Jesus walked through his door into the room. Salvation literally walked into his house, and Zacchaeus responds to the presence of Jesus by changing his relationship with his money. He will now use it to bless others. In the presence of Jesus, Zacchaeus finds that something more he was longing for. It's not enough to remove the idols, remove the surface idols from our lives or the deep idols from our heart. It's not enough to remove them. They must be replaced. Replaced by the presence and the transforming power of God. That's the only way we can be set free from all our idols. And that's what we see happening in this story of Zacchaeus. Because when Jesus invites himself into Zacchaeus' home, he's also inviting himself into Zacchaeus' heart. It's a heart that's wide open because Zacchaeus realizes he needs something more. And when Jesus takes a hold of a heart, all the idols, the surface and the deep, begin to lose their grip. So the next time you find yourself up a tree longing for something more, remember that it's in the presence of Christ. It's in the presence of Christ that we receive and experience a different kind of power from God. It's in the presence of Christ that we receive and experience a different kind of approval from God. It's in the presence of Christ that we receive and experience a different kind of comfort from God. It's in the presence of Christ that we receive and experience a different kind of security from God. A kind that money cannot buy. And so as God continues to work on our hearts, may our eyes be open to the riches we have. Not in our bank account, not in our stock portfolio, not in our property, but the riches we have in Christ, who relentlessly invites himself into our hearts until all, the surface and the deep, all the idols fall. Let's stand and sing.